where he kind of finally lays out a very tangible, at least a good chunk of the core theory, you know. So we'll get some elaboration as we get into the chapters that follow, two chapters that follow. But tonight I think we're in a good position to kind of appreciate what he's doing and maybe even start to raise some critical questions about it, because it's not straightforward how this theory is going to sit vis-a-vis the other theories we've had in the course. So there's plenty of stuff to talk about and get started with critique, but how much of that happens tonight, we'll just have to see. Sometimes when you see something for the first time, you kind of need to take it in for a while. So, okay, any questions before we get going? That's doing okay? All right, so before we get into the actual chapter, well, these are our three study questions. We basically want to understand, what is he saying about Enlightenment philosophers? This is the last attack he's going to make on philosophy, thankfully, but I kind of agree with a lot of his attacks, so I guess I'm okay with that. How did he work with this guy, Craig Joseph, to develop the CIFLS foundations? And remember, CIFLS is, let's go ahead and get this into your notes where you can add. So these are the five moral foundations he's introducing at the end of the chapter. You guys have that grid in the text that you can access. I would keep that handy because we're going to be using that a lot, but we'll go through the chapter. So care, harm, you could write out the words if you want. Fairness, cheating. Loyalty, betrayal. Authority, subversion. And sanctity, degradation. Okay, go ahead and just make those headings in your notes and leave some white space to add stuff to them, because we're going to be adding a bunch of notes. And we have a small group experience that might allow you to add some notes too. So leave a good chunk of space there for that. So those are our study questions, and we'll be able to get into our work directly. All right, so I think it's because I'm doing this philosophy of food class. By the way, I think I accidentally sent you guys something on philosophy. Sorry about that. But I really took this taste metaphor seriously. So before we start the chapter, I want to tell you a little bit about retronasal olfaction, which is a kind of cool phrase already, but it's a pretty cool thing, too. So retronasal olfaction is one of the ways that we experience taste in a complex way. I mean, I was just reading in a new book today, humans can distinguish pretty immediately about 10,000 smells. So if you walk into a friend's group house and they're barbecuing meat, you can tell that. If they're making chicken, you can tell that, right? Some of us are better at detecting smells than others. But to really taste things, you need to, let me put a picture up. That'll help. Cool, we do. And it's not like we've known this for a long time, but I don't know the exact date. But so orthonasal olfaction is smelling stuff, right? That's sniffing things with your nose. Retronasal satisfaction is what happens when you take the airborne molecules from food and we have this ability to bring them into our sinuses, where we have this beautiful thing called the olfactory bulb, which has receptor sites for the flavonoids and molecules that we can experience taste from. So those lock on together. Now that's the first part of the story. The second part of the story is that the brain gets involved in our understanding of what that taste is. So we often talk about, researchers talk about a taste image that comes from the brain. And what's cool about this is that it means that we're not actually limited to experiencing taste solely by what the food does. That's kind of the point for your notes. That's actually going to carry over to our chapter. Our experience of taste is functionally limitless because we can use our big brains to influence our perception of taste at this level. Now, smelling, that's straightforward. You know, tastes on your tongue. Were you guys taught the tongue map? I think we finally got rid of the tongue map. Did you guys learn the tongue map?
Yeah.
Totally bogus, apparently. I was totally deceived as a kid. One more way adults deceived me as a kid. It turns out you can taste all those tastes, the six basic tastes, right? you can taste those all over your tongue.
So that's the point. The point is that retronasal olfaction allows us to base it, it.
Here's what it explains in food. It explains why there's no limit to tastes, and it explains why humans can develop very radically different tastes that some groups associate with home cooking and wow, this is great, and other people would be like, are you kidding? I'm not going to eat your dog. You know, so taste can be, or I was reading about an insect, somebody who's going to insect restaurants in Vietnam. You know, so it explains something that's really been puzzling to food people, how it is that human taste experience can be so diverse and yet so incompatible. So two people can taste the same thing, but if you weren't acculturated into it, it might not taste very very good to you. Okay, so here's the connection to ethics. I don't want to keep talking about philosophy of food. The connection to ethics is that Haidt's saying that moral, you can start your notes on this, moral sense is like taste. Morality is, our moral experience is more like our experience of cuisine than we think. And he makes three specific points I tried to pull out this time around. One point is that like taste, we have these sensitivities, these things that we're drawn to. And those are the foundations. So you know, just like there's sweet and salty and sour and bitter and umami, you know, you could say our evolution has given us these centers of moral concern. So, you know, some people think bitterness, the ability to taste bitterness is a part of our ability to detect poisons, because poisons are often bitter. And so you could, the analogies are really standing out to me this time around because I'm teaching philosophy of food for the first time. So that's one, that just like in cuisine, we might have moral sensitivities that came to us through evolution. Second point is that morality is rich. It's not reducible to one taste. That's the point of his restaurant metaphor at the beginning of the chapter, right? Morality is like seeing, it's like aesthetics. That's a good analogy for your notes. It's like food is like aesthetics too. It's like cuisine or aesthetics, it's a sensory rich, it's a conceptually rich experience of the world along many axes, not just, maybe not even five, maybe many more. We're going to work with these. Third point he makes is that like cuisines, there's a lot of variation, but like cuisines, there are boundaries. So this goes back to our relativism point. If you say, you know, moral philosophers have often tried to reduce morality to one thing, as soon as your theory has more than one thing, you kind of wonder, well, how much variation is possible? You know, if morality can be any variation on these five focuses, you know, foundations, isn't that relativism? And what he's saying in response is, no, there are boundary conditions. There are things that don't count as morality, just like there's things that don't count as food. So there's variation but boundaries. That's the third point. Okay, so we're going to come back to this when we actually lay out these foundations and look at the chart and do a little small group experience on thinking about whether we see these foundations in our moral experience, like every day. And I really want you to come back with examples of that. I'll try to generate some too. And that'll be our entree into critically assessing these foundations, at least starting that tonight. But before we get to that, the first chunk in your notes is the analogy between morality and cuisine. The second chunk in your notes would be what he's saying about Enlightenment philosophers, okay? So let's get that in here and understood. So he makes this claim that Enlightenment philosophers agreed that the medievals were wrong. So in medieval moral philosophy, morality is a duty that comes to you from a transcendent source, God. And the Enlightenment, which follows the scientific revolution, fundamentally rejects that. And the Enlightenment, it involves a move toward naturalism, but not completely. A lot of Enlightenment philosophers are not naturalists. So specifically, let me line it up here like this. Enlightenment philosophers agreed that that we shouldn't be thinking about God as the transcendent source of morality because we have no way of investigating God's mind. But they disagreed about whether there was another transcendent source of morality. So in the Enlightenment, you basically get two views. One view is rationalism. Remember, Haidt accused philosophers of having a rationalist delusion. And the other direction is more empiricist. And the rationalists include people like Kant and Mill and Bentham. And what they're saying in different ways is that there is a transcendent source for morality. It's called reason. So the Enlightenment rejects God as a transcendent source for morality, but some Enlightenment thinkers thought they had discovered the true transcendent source for morality. It's reason. And remember this, remember how this comes out in Kant's thinking, right? Act always to promote the idea of others as rational beings. Act out of respect for others' rationality. And you can see it also in utilitarian thought. Utilitarian thought is committed to the rational principle that everyone's happiness matters as much to them as yours does to you, right? So there's a kind of abstraction. The empiricists, on the other hand, were people like Hume and Hutcheson, who we associate with moral sense theory, and eventually Darwin. These are people who are, these are the true naturalists in the story. And moral psychology goes under here too, right? So Haidt and all that. And here's what they're saying, right? Remember, Hume said that reason is a slave of the passions. And for Haidt, that's taken up in this idea that intuitions come first, reasoning second. Let's make sure that's lined up in your notes. Hume, you've run across these comments separately in the book before. Let me put them together in your notes. Hume says reason is a slave of the passions. As opposed to, you see how diametrically opposed that is to the rationalist? And what was the second thing? Hume says reason is the slave of the passions and
intuitions.
And yeah, and that's, and I want you to connect that with Haidt's argument from part one of the book that intuitions come first, right? That's passion, reasoning second. Okay? So Haidt is definitely putting himself in this tradition. Okay. So here's the critique. Okay, so that's his. That's what he wants to say about how the Enlightenment lined up vis-a-vis the world that preceded it. But here's his critique. He wants to suggest that Enlightenment rationalists, this is the major claim for your notes, Enlightenment rationalists were kind of autistic. Kind of a mean thing to say. Did anybody feel like he was kind of, I know, that's not a nice thing to say. What?
Felt like he was being an internet bully.
He was being kind of a troll. He was being like a moral psychology troll. But he doesn't mean it as an ad hominem. He's really clear in saying he's not trying to make an accusation against them. Yeah,
well,
what did you think?
Only, I mean, that's only if you believe that being autistic is a bad thing.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. Yeah. Because, you know,
it's not a negative thing necessarily.
Right. And, you know, I'm here to defend a claim about philosophers that I've only came to in the last few years, which is that we are a little bit, and it's not a bad thing. In fact, sometimes philosophy, so what I mean by that is philosophers don't score high in observation tests. When I'm with my science biology friends, they're like, how could you not notice what we just saw? You know, like a bird, a tree. I can't keep my tree species straight. I don't notice things. It's really embarrassing. And philosophers have been, it's been a stereotype for philosophers. There are stories throughout the history of philosophy of how you know, isn't it a cliche of the philosopher to be kind of spaced out and not really noticing what's going on in the world? Theoretically, that's because, the idea is that that's because we're trying to abstract from the world to get theories and essences and insights. You can decide what you think about philosophers on your own, but the point is that it's a good, I'm glad you made that comment, because he's not saying they're bad people because they're kind of low empathy, high systematizers. He's saying that's the psychology of, that's part of the psychology of the Enlightenment. So you remember this chart that he had where this is the low empathy and this is the low sympathy high systematizing. Am I getting this right?
Yeah.
This is high empathy, and this is low systematizing. So systematic thinkers are people who want to reduce things to one principle. They want to have an abstract framework that totally theorizes the phenomena, and scientists are like that. In doing science, you often abstract from your empathetic reactions to things. So this autism zone is where he places Kant and Bentham. It is slightly pejorative in the sense that these are people who aren't experiencing the full range of emotions. And one of the reasons we worry about autistic spectrum is because people with autistic spectrum disorders don't always pick up on other people's intentions, right? They don't. How many of you have known people who have either had Asperger's or autistic spectrum disorder? Right. It's becoming very common, and we're noticing that a lot of us are on the autistic spectrum range. We're just in a range that's called normal, whereas there are people who are extremely aware and empathetic, and extremely aware of other people's intentions. And those are trade-offs. That can be a burden as well, right? Because you're going to feel those emotions all the time. So it's a good point you make that, you know, it's, you don't want to make a pejorative judgment universally. On the other hand, he is saying they don't get certain things because of that. And so if you want to, I just want to digress on Bentham because maybe some of you haven't seen him recently. But Bentham is with us still. This also helps you see how strange he was. So the next time you're in London, you should go to the University of London.
Is that a miniature or is that an actual?
That is the dude, yeah. He's there in his full glory. His head is between his legs because it started to rot, and so they found a way to pickle it, and they put a wax head on him. Jeremy Bentham was a funny guy. I mean, it's not your typical person who writes a will leaving money to the university but saying that they want to be present at the trustee meetings forever. You know, but that's a guy who's got some ideas in his head, right? Okay. He also had this idea that we should stuff famous people and put them in parks so that we can all like visit them. And they actually had to restuff. If you go visit him in London, you'll see a little display where they show that they had to restuff him in the 70s because he was starting to go off a little bit. You know, but he'd been there a long time, so. So he's my point is he's a quirky guy.
You can't always go and see it though, because I mean they do have meetings in there.
That's right. I think they still bring them. See, they've got them on wheels. I think they still bring them out. Yeah.
Just kind of them on wheels.
Yeah. Bentham on wheels.
Like,
that'd be a good indie group name. What?
They're like, I don't know, British people are kind of like.
You could say it's a national characteristic. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're
I mean,
quirky.
If it was in the wheel, they're like, oh, I guess we'll just do it. Like it's not really.
Yeah.
That.
You can see this is a person, the point for your notes is this is a person who will put an idea ahead of what many people would regard as a kind of a normal, full-blooded emotional reaction to things, right? And so the criticism is, let's get this right, the criticism is that systematizers abstract too much from empathy and emotion, just like autistic spectrum disorder folks have trouble noticing emotions and intentions in human interactions. Okay? So this is a way of getting you ready for his theory, which he thinks doesn't do that. And so let's get into that a little bit, and then we can set up our discussion. The thing I want to really impress on you is that he's really thinking about morality as something we bring all of our emotions and reasoning to. Yeah.
I just had a question.
Sure.
When he was talking about Kant's view of morality, he kept using the word timeless. I didn't really understand what he meant by that.
Very good. Yeah, let's reinforce that, because it applies to both Kant and the utilitarians. Kant thought that the categorical imperative applied at all times, to all people, in all places, right? So nothing about, right? So that's the point. And the utilitarian, right? You've been reading a lot of Singer, right? Singer thinks there's no difference between helping the kid who falls into the pool, who's in front of you, and helping the kid around the world. The principle of utility applies to all people at all places and all times. So the point for your notes, thanks, Laura, this is a good thing to add to your note, is that systematizers tend to abstract from locality and particularity. They tend to think that it's that the particular challenges involved, the particular emotions involved, are not relevant to the solution. Are you feeling that? It's a big contrast, yeah.
And kind of the same thing as you're talking about, does that have to do with, because Hume was like kind of based morality on intuition, and then Kant was kind of thought that intuition was more subjective, and so that's that kind of...
Yeah, that's a good thing to line up with this. Yeah, so just like our contemporary Kantian, Christine Korsgaard, was telling us, look, it's not until this particular logical state where the person has an intention in front of their minds and they're asking this highly reflective question, is this a good reason for wanting this goal? You know, it's not until that point, and that's a very logically specified, abstractly specified dividing line, right? It's not like saying, you know, morality is like understanding beauty. You approach it with all of your emotions, and there's these challenges. Totally different. That's the contrast I'm trying to develop. Okay? Are we good on that? So let's get into the foundations. This is a lot of fun. It's kind of a payoff in a way, because what he wants to tell you is the way he figured out the foundations was working with this guy at University of Chicago, and here's what you need for that. And it kind of relates to the second study question. So how did they develop the C+ foundations? Okay, so here's the basic answer. In evolutionary psychology, it's typical to look at the brain as being modular. So what does modularity mean? Some of you guys might have run across this in some of your psych studies or even in biology. Modularity refers to the idea that we may have developed specific capacities, cognitive and emotional capacities, around specific challenges that we faced in our evolutionary past. So, for instance, we have a really, we have kind of a snake detection device. How many of you have had the experience of thinking you saw something out of the corner of your eye, like a little animal or maybe a snake, right? Put it in your notes this way, we have hyperactive detection devices. That's one of our modules. We go overboard in perceiving faces in clouds and critters out of the corner of our eyes. And the evolutionary explanation for that module would be that the people who weren't hyper predator detectors were the people who sat around and said, it's probably nothing. Don't worry about it. And those are the people who were less likely to pass their genes on. You see how they're like, that's not a snake. Let's just keep playing cards. It's great. You know. So that's kind of the idea behind modularity. I'll say it one more time. Humans have developed specific competencies that relate to specific evolutionary challenges, like detecting predators, detecting disease and contamination. I already mentioned bitterness, being able to taste bitterness. Presumably, if there were humans that couldn't taste bitterness, they had a disadvantage in detecting poison and bad food. Right? So that's the idea of modularity. Now, the second part of modularity is that we have really huge brains, so we're not stuck looking for snakes. The point for your notes is that because of our big brains, did I mention how many cc's our modern human brain has? 1,400 cc's. It's like the Harley of evolution's brain power. I mean, we've got huge brains. We started at like 450 cc's. So, I mean, triple. That's pretty darn good for just 2 million years. Okay, so because of our big brains, we're not stuck with the modules that we evolved with. We can actually repurpose. So we can go from snake detection to predator detection. And we can go from actual predators to... We recognize all kinds of abstract predators, like here's an abstract predator. If you don't promote personal responsibility, people will become lazy. You know, that kind of intuition. So we can actually, the point for your notes is we can repurpose original triggers for these modules to new challenges. And we're going to see that in this chart. So if you could turn to your what page is your chart on? Maybe I could put mine on the
146.
So most of you have that. Look on with someone if you don't. I mean, I want to kind of walk through the chart with you as a way of getting you ready for your small group discussion. 146, you said in your book? Okay, so in mine it's 125. Okay, so here's the idea. Let's start with care and harm. I said you're going to have some notes here, so let's start filling in a little bit. And you don't have to duplicate the chart, just maybe some small notes that kind of capture this. So he really puts this first because this is about kids originally. And you know this evolutionary just so story. Humans have long gestation periods, 9 months. And after the baby's born, right, humans can't take care of themselves. We're not like those other species that can just pop out and kind of go running off and taking care of themselves. So women are incapacitated by childbirth in a way that men are not. And so men might have different strategies for getting their genes into the next generation, right? I mean, an ancient Homo sapien might think, I'll just impregnate as many women as I can. But the way the argument goes, that's not going to be a good strategy either, right? So the strategy that matters the most is one where we can get people to have a high trigger for care. And so he's thinking, what one of our sensitivities is care for kids, and people who are able to harness their emotions and stay committed to child rearing had more success in their genetics. So that's kind of at the core of things. And so then as you move right, you get other things that come into the picture. For instance, two-party coalitions are the original challenge. This is the cooperate, we're going to run into this later in the course, cooperate, defect, right? So we're social species, we have to form coalitions with other people, especially the people we raise our kids with, but also other partners, people we hunt with, people we're going to enter into partnerships with, and really just friends. You know, friends have cooperation agreements. That's what it means to be a good, part of what it means to be a good friend is that this is somebody you can count on not to bail on you when you need them. Loyalty and betrayal have to do with, so this is kind of two-party coalitions. These are group coalitions. So we have triggers for loyalty and betrayal. We feel disgusted when somebody's a traitor, right? When somebody cuts and runs from a group, that's, right? Isn't that a problem? Mm-hmm. I got to tell you, I got a great one for you. I can't wait. I got to tell you now. This came up just last week. No, 2 weeks ago. And it turned out some people in the other class knew about this. So when my son was 5 years old, my first son, he had a birthday party. And one of the people at the birthday party was a guy named Cody Della Strada. And Cody Della Strada now grew up and wanted to be a writer. And so he wrote for some, I heard he got some things in BuzzFeed. He got some things in New Yorker. Blog or something, not the magazine. It's almost impossible to get into the New Yorker. And then he wrote an article for The Guardian. Have any of you heard of this?
Yeah.
You're a Spokaneite, right?
Oh, no.
No, you're not. Oh,
yeah.
Hey, you are. Okay. You've heard of this?
So
oh, my God.
Oh, I saw that.
Oh.
No, I saw that. Oh, I heard that.
He wrote an article for The Guardian betraying his hometown of Spokane.
Oh, I heard about that.
Oh. Cody, how could you do it? And so what he did was he said, Spokane is this desolate place where the only thing people have is basketball. And
Mark Few.
And if we didn't have basketball, we'd all kill ourselves. And it was horrible. And I felt it because he came to my son's five-year-old birthday party. And so Chris and his friends actually got Cody to write an apology that the Guardian ran. Yeah, because it's like, they were saying, you know, dude, don't do this. You don't do this. And what they're feeling is the disgust of betraying your group. If you ever get an opportunity to rat out your hometown, don't take it. Really. I mean, it's like, and what would be, like, think about talking stink. That might come up in your, you know, you don't use that phrase. Do we use that phrase?
No.
Anyway, talking bad about people, right? That might come in, up in some of your group discussions. So our group, so these are triggers that we have that relate originally to the need to be solid with your group. Now, this one is really, I'm noticing this is post-agriculture. This is from my reading on food, I've come to appreciate what anthropologists tell us about foragers and hunter-gatherers, which is that they didn't have hierarchy. So authority and subversion, in my opinion, has to be a recent one, and that makes it a little different than these others. Because we didn't have, so this is about respect for hierarchy, but it's also about the need to subvert. So this one's distinctive because, well, maybe harm is like this too. So these are usually the positive ones, right? That's pretty obvious. But in two cases, if you think that sometimes it's good to harm your enemies, which I'm not sure about, but it certainly has been a tried and true strategy for humans, then you might think that, there's a positive notion to harm, right? Harm isn't just about not harming kids. It could also be about beating the crap out of your neighbors who are threats to you, right? And we used to do that a lot. Likewise, subversion, we need people who will subvert authority. Why? We need authority, presumably because after agriculture we developed more complex societies, which would only work if people respected hierarchical relationships like priests and, of course, philosophers. But why do we need people who will subvert?
To prevent corruption.
Sometimes you have to have a revolution, right? So this one also has, I think, a little positive, which is another anomaly. These two are a little different. I don't know that betrayal is ever really a good thing. I'm not sure cheating is ever really a good thing. Okay, and then with sanctity degradation, we've got these original triggers that have to do with detecting bad food and diseased people, and then we transfer those triggers onto contemporary sexual ethics. Contemporary intuitions we have about degrading behavior, right? Some of you might say, many of you would probably say that sex work is intrinsically degrading, right? German sex workers, they always are the ones in the news. I don't know why I focus on them. But German sex workers argue that this is their job. This is what they do, right? And so it's not degrading. It's my work.
So this is what drives people to kink shame?
To what?
To kink shame.
Kink, to what kind of shame?
Kink shame.
I don't know about that. What is that? Sorry. Is that like shaming someone?
It's like pretty much shaming someone for like their fetish or something.
Right. Yeah, well, shaming behaviors, you're dead on. Shaming behaviors come right out of this. When you shame someone, I hope you guys don't do this too much, but if you were to shame someone, you would be saying you're doing something degrading, right? You should be ashamed of yourself, right? And Italians are always yelling, vergogna, vergogna, and they're protesting. Shame, shame on you. Yeah, when you think people are acting low in a way that's degrading or low or base. So we can actually re-trigger this onto nobility, right? Our sense of what a great humanitarian is. There weren't great humanitarians in our ancestral past, but there were people who acted in a relatively sanctified or degraded way. And we can take that original trigger that we needed for recognizing contaminants, and we could apply it to all kinds of contemporary versions of sanctity. High-mindedness, humanitarians, people who just live in a pure way, people who won't talk stink about others, for example. So the basic idea, if you've got that chart out, if you've been following that chart, you see we're basically talking about an adaptive challenge in our evolutionary history. Then we're talking about the triggers that served those challenges, that served us in those challenges. And then we're talking about the contemporary, the new triggers. So new triggers for care harm would be to care about the fate of the environment. That could also show up under sanctity, by the way. New triggers for care harm would be to worry about the way we treat animals. Humans haven't really worried about abuse of animals historically, but now we do, because we can transfer our care harm intuitions from care for kids to care for cute baby seals. right? And for even for tardigrades, we can even generate a little, right? I mean, like, what's happening to all the tardigrades right now? Are they turning to glass? Okay. So you're getting the idea. So what I'd like you to do is keep that chart handy while you're in small group. Here's the small group prompt. I'd like you to try to generate examples from your own experience, and feel free to tell some stories. You can always say, I have a friend who had this experience, if you don't want to, like, put it in first person. But tell some stories. Tell some stories about instances of moral taste or perception, taste perception, that fall under each of these categories. One thing I'm interested in is how easy it is for you to do that. I'd like you to come back with examples from each of these. And then as you get into your examples, as you start to share your stories and examples, they don't have to be personal stories. They could just be examples. I'd like you to try to see if you're noticing any problems or issues with the foundations theory. Because we're just beginning, now that we're getting it out on the board, we're just beginning a critical discussion. Now we'll start with some criticisms tonight and we'll add some as we go. Okay, so could you get into groups and do that? Try to generate examples and see if you can flesh out these modules. You know, one thing I want to clear, I want to get us clear on at the beginning is, does this tell us what's right? He's up there. It's not going to bother him. And so you're running, you're on your way out. That's great.
I'm not
chill. Oh, it's okay. No, he's not interested in us. Okay, open up the window.
I'm scarred.
Ah, you have a trigger. You see, you have a trigger for these. So, yeah, open the window. Maybe he'll go out. Okay. Okay. Oh, there's a screen. The window, he won't get out. Okay, I just need a few minutes. Let's just get this just so that we kind of, when we come back to this, we'll... Are we okay?
If we ignore him,
oh my God.
Yes.
See, it senses
right.
My fear. That I've experienced this before. It'll follow me. It'll dive bomb. Wasps are evil.
It doesn't look like.
Well,
kill it.
Just
kill
it.
Someone
I mean, we don't have any. Like, I don't think it violates any of the foundations. I have no group loyalty.
Did you do it?
Look at that. You've defended the group. See, do we feel group pride? Thank you. We protected one of our. I know, like, yeah, because you might say, wow, did we really need to kill that guy? Yeah. All right, let's just do this real quick. I know we're losing our focus here, but let me just try and get this into the... So the point is, I'll make short work of this, just for your notes. The moral foundations, Haidt's moral foundations don't tell you what's right, and that's a big difference from other philosophical philosophical theories of ethics, right? That try to give you a principle that says, act always in such and such a way, right? So, but what he's giving us is an explanation for the sources of our moral responses, and he doesn't even care if he's got exactly the right five. He's probably right about a lot of these. I mean, he's right to the extent that he's right about the core evolutionary challenges that are involved here. For your notes, the idea is, no, this is not a normative theory. A normative theory is like Kant and Singer, and Mill, which tells you what's right. But this is an explanatory theory, and we're going to get more information about this that helps us understand maybe something about moral discourse. Second question, do we all experience C+ the same way? And here I'm just going to be a little bit of a spoiler here, and kind of maybe I've already done this, but he's going to, in the next couple of chapters, he's going to show you empirical evidence for saying, well, liberals tend to have this two-channel morality. Liberals tend to focus on harm, care, fairness, and cheating. Conservatives tend to have a five-channel. And he's got some really interesting empirical evidence for that comes out of some studies with pretty high-end numbers of participants. So the idea for your notes is that we don't all experience C-plus the same way. We experience it based on personality characteristics and experiences in our lives that have heightened our triggers for different foundations. So the equalizer metaphor makes sense here. We each have different settings, different sensitivities to these, just like equalizer settings on an equalizer. And so it's not a normative theory. We don't experience it all the same way. And we don't need, and the third question was, how do we know this is the right set? Well, we don't need to be exactly right about it, because the general claim is that we have these modules. There is some adaptability to them, some flexibility to them, and we just have to be sort of right about them. I mean, if you can think of a big evolutionary challenge that's connected with a moral response that isn't captured by this, let me know. Like I said, I may have told you, he's going to break fairness and cheating out into liberty and oppression, because he thinks he doesn't think liberals and conservatives experience fairness the same way. We'll go through this later, but he thinks liberals think of fairness in a different way than, I don't want to go into it right now. We're kind of coming to the end. Okay. Yeah. Question.
So I know we talked about this a little bit,
sure.
But does he say that like the top ones are positive and the bottom ones are mostly?
I'm going to keep an eye out for language there. I'm not sure. I was just this time around. I was noticing that these two seem to have positive examples for the bottom ones, and so I don't know if you noticed anything. I think he's implying that these are generally. The top ones are the positive ones. He does explicitly say in the next chapter, actually, that subversion plays a positive role when we need to overthrow an overreaching authority or corrupt authority. I don't know if he'd agree that there are positive uses of harm, but clearly it is adaptive for humans to be able to harm their enemies before their enemies harm them. It's not a happy thought to end on, but, you know, it's there, right? So... good question. Yeah, others? Yeah, please.
So, I don't know, a lot of these are kind of like somewhere close to like an emotion-based system. So,
yeah.
Would you think it would be a good thought to think that he might
good.
Think that all emotions fit within these?
Good. We haven't paid much attention to that, but that's a good thing for us to close on. Look at, let's just read off the emotions and see if they fit. So compassion is the one that he associates with it. Anger, gratitude, and guilt he associates. How have you felt when you've let down your partners, right? Group pride, rage at traitors. That's how we feel about Cody right now. No, he wrote an apology. See, so we feel like we don't feel so bad about him. Respect and fear are the motivating emotions here. And disgust. So yeah, do you think he's covering a pretty wide range of emotions? Because you could also, one way to get a criticism out of this is to identify other emotions that are morally relevant but don't appear here. That would be
love. Would say care, like maybe would fit into it, but I feel like love is
very interesting.
Different level of these, because there's like, because you could say that love and then completely just like,
good.
I guess the opposite of love is just like not caring at all.
Apathy. Yeah. I mean, love is clearly part of care. Where else could it show up? We love our groups. I mean, love's an incredibly broad emotion, right? It goes everything from loving your country to loving your partner, right? We can love things that are very sanctified, right? We can love God.
So then where would apathy be within all of that? Because I think it is a
distinct
opposite.
Yeah.
And I think love...
No, that's you're on the right track. Let's keep working on that. I mean, it's about emotions that are morally relevant that may or may not be figuring up in here. Yeah, good.
So it doesn't, like, I don't really know where happiness would clearly fit into all
good.
Of these.
Yeah.
So would it be, like, the combination of, like, a good moral choice would lead to happiness?
Good, good. So, yeah, so one way to look at happiness in this model is that thriving is happiness. So meeting your evolutionary challenges is happiness in the sense that you're thriving. Another way of looking at it, and the happiness course gets into this, is that nature doesn't really care if you're happy. Nature cares that you get your genes into the next generation. If being happy helps you do that, great. So the happiness that we experience from being good partners, good group members, good parents, you know, being concerned about the care of people. That there's happiness all along here, right? And it depends on how you theorize happiness. It might be that happiness is a side effect of that helps us be good because we reward each other. We give each other pats on the back. Say, hey, thanks for showing up to help me move. That was great. You're a good friend. Oh, I feel good, right? So it could be a reinforcer. It's hard to say. It comes up in the happiness class. Good question. Okay, guys, let's break there. Okay? See you guys in 2 days.